Hey, what up? Welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and you are listening to All Ball, where today's guest is head coach of Georgia Tech, Josh Pastor. He'll take us through his journey growing up in Houston, how his dad became like an AAU legend, really kind of interesting, humble beginnings, and how he felt as part of a national championship team at Arizona when he was a walk-on who was working out a lot of the players. There's a bunch of really good stuff in here. It's a two-part interview. This is part one. And it's interesting because he just had a tremendous point guard finish as ACC Player of the Year at Georgia Tech. And the point guard has been wildly discussed. I've been told time and again that the position has changed. You can't play the way that you were taught to play. And then I give you Chris Paul. Now, look, Chris Paul, I mean, he averaged 25 and 10. Part of it was he averaged 25. Part of it was he was playing against backups. And part of it is you got to score. You got to keep the defense honest. But there's just a difference to how he plays as opposed to a Russell Westbrook, right? The numbers look the same to the layman, but the style is very, 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 very different. And finally seeing a point guard, the truest of point guards, get the acclaim that he deserves because he finally got out of that second round and to this point isn't injured is a great thing, not a good thing. A great thing. I guess the question is, maybe we'll ask this of coaches, is does it change the way you evaluate the position that Chris Paul this far in can still do it the way he's always done it? That's a pretty good question, right? Well, that's why I do what I do. I would point out that they've played banged up teams. I mean, that's fair. That's not in anywhere an unfair commentary about how and why they've been able to do what they've been able to do. On the other hand, like if we're going to say that, we got to point out that they completely and thoroughly whooped the hell out of the Denver Nuggets. And look, it felt like dead to rights beaten, but the mistake that the Lakers and Anthony Davis got hurt at the end of the first half of game four, but the Lakers were up 2-1 and they couldn't kill their spirit. Like that was a big thing. They couldn't kill their spirit. And when you can't kill somebody's spirit, when you allow them to hang around and believe they have a chance to win a game, these are the type of things that oftentimes happen, right? So I think for Monty Williams, considering all of, do people know that Monty Williams lost like 2 years of college because he had a heart issue? It was right around the Hank Gathers time. They started testing people's hearts and they shut him down for like a year and a half. And this really, really happened. It's special that for Monty, and you know, I believe it's pretty special for Chris Paul, considering how he's been viewed or how he's been portrayed by so many in that, well, he always gets hurt or you can't be a 6-foot guard and do it anymore. Not that way. You got to do it the Steph Curry, the Trae Young way. I beg to differ. Still pretty special to watch. All right, more to come on that. First, let's get to our first part of our talk with Josh Pastor, the head coach of Georgia Tech.
Okay, so this is actually my favorite part. Your first memories of basketball. Now, you can't say what you're told. Your actual first memories of basketball are what and where?
Well, good question. My first memories, you know, and what was told. I mean, yeah, that's a good question. I haven't been asked that maybe in a long time. But I do remember in fifth grade telling my father I was watching the Lakers and Celtics. This was when I was in fifth grade. I was watching the Lakers and Celtics play on one of the national networks on a weekend. And I remember telling my dad that, you know, and I, even when I was younger at that age, I loved hoops. I remember telling my dad that, hey, look, if I can't play in the NBA, because I wanted to, you know, who doesn't want to play in the NBA? I said, the next best thing to playing was coaching. And I said, I'm going to put all my energies towards coaching so it allows me to stay in the game. I remember telling that as a fifth grader.
Okay, so this is in Houston, right?
This was in Houston, Texas. I grew up in Houston, Texas. And And then I made my way on to the University of Arizona.
Wait, don't start skipping steps on me. Okay. So when you're a kid, like you're fifth and sixth grade, did you play travel ball? Was your dad coaching you? Like what was the setup?
Yeah. You know what? I was playing travel ball. You know, I was playing all the sports. I was into baseball, football, soccer. I mean, I played everything, but, I did, my dad actually started a AAU team at the time. And it was just really to kind of spend more time, father, son type thing, never thinking of where it could go to.
Did he do this for a living at the time? Was this?
No, he did not. He was not in basketball. He ran a competitive basketball league in our local community on every Saturday morning, all day Saturdays. It was called the Competitive Basketball League, the CBL. And he started a travel team that we just called the Kingwood All-Stars. I grew up in Kingwood, Texas, which is north of Houston, back in the day, they called the Intercontinental Airport is now the George W. Bush Airport, but just north of that. But every Saturday we would have the CBL, be a local community basketball league we would play. And so, but that was just doing it because he knew how much I loved basketball and it was for the community. He did it for the youth and the kids. But that then Doug moved into the Houston Hoops. And that's when the Houston Hoops, which is still going strong today, my dad eventually, my father, Hal Pastner, eventually went into the tournament business. And both he had his first company with the tournament business. Later on, this is what he went into full time. He did the Vision Sports. And then he went into Bigfoot Hoops. He sold Vision Sports, sat out a couple of years, came back under Bigfoot Hoops, and then ended up selling that. He's out of it now, but still runs the Houston Hoops.
Okay, so fifth, sixth grade, were you good? Were you the best player? Did he go out and recruit dudes? Like, you're this Kingswood, you know, travel team. How good were you? How good was your team?
Well, at the Kingwood, it was in Kingwood, our Kingwood All-Stars. I mean, we were just a local group. I was a solid player. I could shoot the ball. I knew the game. But, you know, I was solid. It wasn't until we moved on that we start, you know, and you moved to the, when we got more towards the Houston Hoops, was when you started attracting and recruiting talent and better players. When I say better players, just, you know, higher level guys that you weren't just focused into that city, into that local community. You stretched out all throughout Houston. You know, eventually, obviously, as the Houston Hoops continued to progress, you would have guys from Dallas and Louisiana and things like that. But that's kind of how it started and moved from there.
Okay, so high school, who coached you in high school, and what was your high school career like?
And I do want to say, Doug, because you know, I'm obviously, and we'll get into it maybe later, but you know, for people that don't know, and I'm sure they do, the ones that follow you on Twitter and stuff, but you know, how close you were to your father and how your dad was, you know, I call him Coach Gottlieb, how your dad was, you know, he was a college coach, but the amount of kids he helped. And I say this to people all the time, you know, talking about your father and other people in the grassroots industry, the amount of young people they've helped all throughout. And not only is it a great bonding between the father and son, like you and obviously your brother, but the time and effort that your dad had put in to help so many other people and the grassroots world of that, was amazing. And obviously your dad was a pioneer in grassroots basketball. And I wanted to make note of that. He's one of the great, great people that I've ever come across in all of hoops. So, I've always had just a fondness for your dad. But, when I was at Kingwood High School, I was coached by Royce Hoosman. I played on the B team, my freshman year. And then my sophomore year, I was on the sophomore team. And then my junior year, I was to be able to make the varsity group. And then my senior year, I started and was the, you know, and I played the team there. So it was good.
So, okay. So it's interesting you bring up my dad and how, you know, part of your dad's reasoning for starting a team is so that you spend more time together. Like my, and I read an article the other day, which was fascinating, which is, you know, like, the car ride is the new dinner table, right? Where now, you know, parents, because kids have all these activities, you don't have time to sit down at dinner table. So you grab something to eat and that's when you have your conversations about the day or whatever. Like that was my life, you know, like my dad would pick me up and, you know, whether we would go train with like, you know, I had two or three different trainers I worked through in terms of like my body, or go pick up a teammate and then go to practice. And I would have my books with me and, you know, I'd have to kind of give it a passing glance, whatever, do a little studying. And then I was listening to sports radio or some of his, like he had old time radio on tapes, but like most afternoons when we'd have practice, like that was my existence as a kid. Like, I don't know. Yeah. What do you, that's what I remember. So you're in high school. Okay. You're on the B freshman team. Is that what you said you were on?
I was on the freshman B team my freshman year. And then I was on the sophomore team my sophomore year, then was able to make the varsity my junior year and then started my senior year.
Wait, so how good was your varsity?
The coach, Roy Sussman, was a very good basketball coach, or he is a very good basketball coach. He was there a long time, just, you know, very fundamentally sound. And we had some good players and I loved playing. We had good pickup games. I had a great passion for the game. And I mean, obviously I still do, but just when I was younger, when I look back, I mean, the amount of times, you know, I would play one-on-one with, you know, some of my teammates, we would just go play one-on-one at the local elementary school at the hoop or the front yard. And just, you know, I look back at the amount of, you know, games we would play just again, whether it was pickup basketball or one-on-one or, you know, you just doing those type of things. And, when you're talking about your dad, the training, you know, as you know, a very good friend of yours, a very good friend of mine, Miles Simon, kind of the same thing, you know, him and his closeness of his father, through basketball, which was really cool. And then I remember my dad taking me out in Orange County about when you're talking about shooting. I don't know if you remember, if you know this guy, you ever heard of Des Flood?
Yeah, Des Flood, of course.
Unfortunately, he's passed away, but he was known as one of the great shooting coaches at the time. You know, people would come to him about shooting. And I actually went out there and spent some time with him, believe it or not. And he was a brilliant shooting coach, you know, just with that. So, yeah, knowing that from your area over there.
So how did you decide to go to Arizona? Man, I know, like, I remember talking to Miles about you, and I remember the Sports Illustrated article about you going there to be a coach. But what was the real story behind how you decided this was the spot?
Yeah, you know what? I sent a letter to every single Division I, Division II, Division III, NAIA Division I, and NAIA Division II schools in America. Over 1,000 personal handwritten letters to over 1,000 schools telling them what I wanted to do. You know, look, I recognized at that time I wasn't playing in the NBA. But I still thought I was a good player and I could play. You know, I thought I could go play at Arizona or some school like that. I could just, you know, be good enough in my mind. But I did send a letter to all of over 1,000 schools, personal handwritten letters. And I talked about how I can be a positive impact, a positive teammate. You know, I can work the guys out, you know, all those type of things. Won't count against time limits or anything like that. And Coach Olson saw the letter and responded to me. Now, I think he also liked our AAU team because we had a really, really good players, probably wanted to bring me there and to drag guys that I would drag guys with me to Arizona. But he gave me an opportunity. Now, at that time, I thought, again, I would come in there and I knew Steve Kerr had played there. I thought maybe I'll be the next Steve Kerr or something, you know. Man, after that first pickup game in August when I was there, and guys like Miles Simon and Jason Terry and Mike Bibby, literally in that first pickup game, I knew it was like, nope, not happening. And I could see it right away. And so for myself, really ever being and what was amazing when I was there, Doug, in this first few, because we'd be in the gym all the time. Miles Simon, Michael Bibby, Michael Dickerson, you know, Jason Terry. I tell people all the time I'm the leading rebounder at Arizona because I would just be in the gym. We'd be in the gym all the time. I'd be rebounding for those guys. But those first few months, believe it or not, I would then come in and take my turn shooting, and they would end up rebounding for me. Sure. Mike Bibby was chasing around Miles Simon was chasing around my missed shots, you know, and passing it back to me. We were doing like two ball, three man shooting and all. And I was involved in because I was still thinking I could work on my game. But eventually that midway through that, my freshman year, we stopped doing that because just I was not going to end up being there was no need for that.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
Okay, so I know, like, I was not as outwardly desirous to be a coach as you were, but, you know, like, I always thought I'd do one of three things. I'd keep playing, and then I'd either be a broadcaster or be a coach, right? It's like in your blood, it's in your blood. And, but I didn't take, like, copious notes. Everything is up here, which, you know, sometimes gets skewed. The national championship run. What'd you learn about coaching and players? Because what I think you had the unique ability to do was you kind of got to do both, which coaches wish they could be in that position where, because you were one of the guys, you got to see how the coaches' messages were actually received, right? And because you wanted to be a coach, you could see what works and what doesn't work. What was it about Lou Olson and the coaching staff that allowed you guys to win the national championship from your perspective?
Yeah, you know, first of all, I remember as an 18-year-old freshman, I told the guys in one of the late nights we were shooting early in August or early September, late August, hey, man, we're going to win the national championship, but we've got to be the hardest working team. And I look back when I told the guys that, I'm thinking to myself, what was I thinking to even say that at 18? I'm surprised I didn't, you know, luckily we had good guys at Arizona. They didn't just want to just pummel me because like, who is this walk-on saying this? You know what I mean? Like stay in your lane in a sense, but we had good guys, you know, fortunately. And, but, you know, what I would tell you is a few things. Looking back after that freshman year, we won the championship. One, I remember after we won it, I remember telling my dad, man, this is easy. We're going to do this every year. I remember my dad telling me, man, savor this. And now that I've been in the game for a long time now, even though I'm only 43, but I've been a head coach for 12 years, going on my 13th year, been a long time assistant, you know. You recognize it's almost impossible to win the national championship. I mean, you got to get lucky. You got to get, I mean, it's only one team. So when I look back about being in that rarefied era of being part of a team that's won the national championship, because it's one of the hardest things to do, Doug, is to win six games in a one game scenario when you're dealing with 18 to 22 year olds and, you know, you have an off night shooting or something's going on. It's just, you know, there's a good chance you're going to lose the game. So, but what I've learned through that stretch, number one is Coach Lute Olson. I don't think he gets, even though he's in the Basketball Hall of Fame, I know you feel the same way about Eddie Sutton, Coach Sutton, and thankfully he got in the Hall of Fame. He just well deserved. Probably, you know, should have got in there earlier. But you know this, like guys like Eddie Sutton, and I think the same thing with Lute Olson. They're vastly underrated, even though they're in the Hall of Fame. A lot of people don't put them in the trajectory sometimes of the elite coaches. They don't get talked about as much for whatever reason that is. And I tell people all the time, like Lute Olson single-handedly built the program, literally built the city in Tucson of what he did in Arizona. I mean, took it from just below ground zero, and to bring it to where it is to one of the national elite programs. At a stretch to over 17 years, was the winningest program in the entire country for 17 straight years. I say all that to say, the biggest thing I learned from him, I mean, there's a lot of things I learned from him, but looking at that year, number one, his preparation in practice was just unmatched. His preparation and the way he conducted practice was unbelievable. Two, the respect the guys had for him, both fear and respect.
That's true.
I mean, fear and respect. They did not want to disappoint him. I mean, that was huge. And three, let me tell you this. He's one of the hardest working head coaches in recruiting that I've ever seen. And he didn't have to be that way, but he was in the gym from morning, noon, night. And you know, Doug, when he walked into a place in Southern California in a tournament in Los Angeles or somewhere in the West Coast, it was like a movie star walking in there. You know, here's a guy, he was always dressed appropriate. I mean, like, just like an A-list movie star.
No, you nailed it. Like, there were, I'm trying to think if there's anybody else. There was Krzyzewski was kind of like a mythical figure. Like, he would come in. But I think Lute and Roy were the guys that they'd walk in and everyone would be like, who's he here to see? And Lute was kind of regal, right? The silver hair, like perfectly dressed, like, you know, polo never had any sort of wrinkles in it. I mean, he was always fit, right? So he didn't look like a mess. Some of these guys look like a mess. He was remarkable. When you won the national championship, I'll never forget this shit. I remember going back and watching the game, and like right after the game, like you got like right in front of the camera, and then they kind of shove you out of the way. Like, what was the existence like for you though, as a guy who didn't play, but you're watching and you're very much a part of it? How do you process all that?
Yeah, no, look, I mean, I didn't play, you know, anything in meaningful games that was a real, like, you know, I mean, I would get in when the game, they all wanted a passer game. I was getting in when we were up 20 or more. So, you
know, it called a passer game?
It was called a passer game because that mean the restaurants in Tucson were, everything was better because it was just a good win. No, it was a no stress game and everyone was happy.
We called those get right games. You got to get your stats right.
They call it the passer game. And but I used to tell Miles and those guys all the time, Miles Simon and all those, like, hey man, you got to, it's on you guys to get me in. So like, you guys got to do your part. Like, I can't control it. So you guys got to make sure you do your part. But I say all that to say that, look, I knew at that point I wanted to coach. I knew my playing career was going to be over at, you know, this was it. Like, as in terms of, to get my fix, Doug, I would go to like whether it's the JCC or a local place to go play 5-on-5, you know, just on like Saturday mornings and stuff. But I would be involved in practice here and there, but yeah, I mean, I love to play, but I had to go get that fix of actually playing competitively. Sure. In a game type of atmosphere and more in pickup basketball on Saturday mornings, Sunday mornings, things like that, outside of the team, because the reality of it was, you know, you look at the guys that we had at Arizona. I mean, there was no chance. It was no chance. So, and I want to say this, Coach Olson, his ability to evaluate, you know, everyone talks about recruiting, Doug, and
player evaluation is huge.
I tell people recruiting is easy. Anyone can go see the 1 through 20 and say, okay, he's a really good player. You don't need to be a real expert in basketball to determine who's that. And yeah, recruiting, can you get them and all that? That's enough. But it's about evaluating. The best are able to evaluate. Evaluation is everything. And I'm telling you, I don't know who is much better than Coach Olson at evaluating. I mean, how many guys in the West Coast that ended up being superstars that nobody wanted, that were in backyards of other schools, and people didn't think they were good enough. And also the thing with Arizona that even before I went there, they were, what you were known for was that cactus logo, you know, and on that Saturday, you know, that Saturday afternoon game when in the Pac-12, and or the, at the time, the Pac-10. And so there was always good games like that. And you'd always see the Cactus logo there. And but think about it. I'm going to use a guy like Miles Simon because I know he's, you and him are really close. He was not highly recruited. I don't, you know, and I think Coach Olsen, you know, did a lot, you know.
Well, what happened with Miles was the first day of a live period in the summer before his senior year, Toby Bailey committed to UCLA. And so here's where things are different now than they were. And I think there's some similarities, whatever. Here's where they're different now is we hated Toby Bailey. Like we grew up playing against Toby Bailey and Ricky Price. And at the time, like we didn't like those guys. They were on a rival AAU team. And so it's one thing to not have offered Miles. And like we grew up as UCLA, like it was right there. Like they were, he wasn't as close to the program as I was, but we went to the games and they were recruiting him, but they hadn't offered him yet. So to not offer him right away, to offer Toby and Toby take it, it was like, all right, well, there goes their wing spot, right? And I think they still end up coming around and offering Miles, but it was more the, they didn't offer him at first and they would do the, we just play the five best guys, sort of BS, whatever. He just felt like one of the spots was gone. So that kind of opened him up. And he was the one who was, he kind of got me into thinking about Florida. The two of us, we went to the, I remember going to Final Four in 94 and I was all about Florida because my dad coached and recruited Lon. And he actually visited there and loved it and then got on the plane and realized how far it was to get back. He's like, ah, I can't do it. But yes, he was a little bit of fall through the cracks kind of thing, right? And part of it was like SC, we weren't the cats going to SC, like Stace Bowson went to SC. You know, Cal ended up taking Jelani Gardner and Tony Gonzalez who played with us.
You know, Doug, go ahead. No, and I was going to say, and you bring up some great memories there. And obviously Toby Bailey ended up, you know, they ended up winning the national title.
That's tempting, yeah.
Yeah. And he had a great freshman year. I think they were thinking he was going to, you know, continue to progress, you know, and because I remember how good he, I think that it was his freshman year is when he yes. won the national championship. Yeah. But I'll tell you what, it's amazing in the grassroots world. And you tell me if you agree with me on this. Some of the legends and grassroots are all from the West Coast. And I'm not talking in today's, I'm talking in the past. And I remember, and I tell people, it's like, I remember going to the tournament there. I think it was at Ocean View High School.
You sure? Tournament champions? Yeah,
but they had, and the gym was open, you know, the door was open because you felt the breeze coming in and so, you know, like you look back now, like Izzy Washington, but like, you know, obviously, you know, like at the time there was, I forget who wrote the book. Was it, might've been Dan Wetzel. Was it about,
no, it wasn't Dan Wetzel.
But it was with recruiting.
Play their hearts out. Play their hearts out. That's what it's called.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was, and a lot of it, and then people really don't know this. And you'll know this, but like one of the great, incredible stories was Shea Cotton. And he was like LeBron James before LeBron James in high school, if that makes sense. Obviously, he doesn't have the same career as LeBron James, but the hype, he was at that time. Remember, there's no social media.
No question. Remember, he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated.
In
high school. And that was back. Yeah. So.
Jordan, and his Jordan, jumping ability, like you would talk about, people would, because again, there was no social media. People like the myth about him, the mythical things around the country about him in grassroots basketball. He was LeBron James in high school before LeBron James. Again, it's a different career path, yes. But I don't know if people fully
or Zion, right? He left
or Zion. There you go. Yeah, that right, might even right. be a better comparison.
What's crazy about Shea is he was. He was so talented, so good. His brother wasn't as talented. His brother's like a couple years older, my age or maybe a little bit older. His brother actually made the NBA and had half the talent of Shea. So it really is a, you know, it's about finding a role. It's about the little things, you know. I'm not a proponent of guys going straight from high school to the pros, but if there's a guy that, and that was why he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Could he go straight from high school to the pros? and he didn't, and Kevin Garnett did the year before.
Yeah.
And he probably should have.
Yeah.
And had he done that, he would have stuck in the NBA for a decade.
Well, you know, and I think the book was called Shoe Wars, wasn't it?
Oh, there was one called Shoe Wars as well. Yeah, I was thinking of George Dorman's book on little bit later generation.
No, the one before that, Shoe Wars, and a lot of it was, you know, guy that slips my mind there, but a lot of it was with Southern California recruiting and stuff like that. But it was called Shoe Wars at the time. That kind of was the first talk about grassroots basketball and how everything was maneuvering, you know, in grassroots basketball.
There's actually one called Raw Recruits.
Maybe that's what it is. Raw Recruits. Maybe
Raw Recruits. So Raw Recruits was Armin Katayan. And my dad's actually in that book when I was in sixth grade. This is a true story. This is a great story. When I was in sixth grade, we had a kid named Lorenzo Liloau. And Lorenzo was Samoan. He was 6 foot, mustache. I like my group now. We spot the mustache. We're like, mustache. Oh, we're in trouble. You know, he had muscles. And so he was the best. The two best players in Southern California at that age. Kobe was really good. But it was Cameron Murray and Lorenzo Liloau. And we played Cameron's team in the Southern California Championships for the AAU national title. And we lost. And so they got to pick up two guys from our team. So they picked up me, coach's son, and Lorenzo. And, you know, my dad was, you know, I don't know. Lorenzo's dad started driving a new minivan. And I don't know if Rich Goldberg bought him the minivan or whatever, but we never had Lorenzo Liloau ever again. I don't think he was ever, I think he played, he was good for one more year, and then he was the exact same player.
And I think Rich Goldberg's team was ARC, wasn't it? ARC? Yeah,
ARC.
ARC
Mid-Valley. So yeah. they had Alex Lopez, guys that went on to play in college were very good. I think Michael O'Quinn played for them. Anyway, so yeah, I played for them in that national tournament. We beat everybody. I didn't play that much. And that was Raw Recruits. So it's in Raw Recruits. And it's interesting because there was a line in there in the book, and I'd love your opinion on this. And it was about my dad, and it was, I think Armin wrote it, like, basketball is a game that my dad loved that didn't love him back. And I thought it was pretty harsh at the time. I think there was some reality to it, but I actually now totally disagree. Like, it didn't give him back financially. And when they got fired in 84 and he went up, he was at Oregon State, like a volunteer assistant for a year in 85. But after that, he never got back in. It gave him everything he needed in his life. He wasn't about the money. He liked the game and he liked the kids and he liked helping the kids succeed. Like, that's literally what he loved. And, you know, your dad, I think the game has given him a lot and has given you guys an incredible relationship and it has given you a great amount. What's your perspective on what a reasonable expectation should be on what the game can give you back? Like, how do you perceive something like that?
Yeah, great question, Doug. I mean, look, I mean, the game has been just awesome to all of us. I mean, look, I look at myself here. I mean, I'm coaching in the ACC because of the game of basketball. You know what I mean?
Right.
I've been to multiple countries, you know, I've traveled just all because of basketball. I could have a laundry list of things. And so the people that you meet, the connection, I could just go on, and people love basketball globally. They love basketball. And I can tell you how many doors things have opened just based on even grassroots basketball, because someone's son or daughter wants to be a basketball player and they're in grassroots basketball. I say all that to tell you this, you've coached, you know, obviously, overseas in the Maccabi games, and obviously your dad was a coach, and I know you're coaching your son's group now. And, but you know, with coaching, and I think your dad would agree with this, and I think you'll agree with this, as we all know, when you're a coach, when you, you know, the game is just, it gives you so much. It's so much joy. But there's no doubt when you lose, it hurts. And only a coach can fully understand that. Like, you know, sometimes people say, well, it's just a game. When you are invested emotionally and when that ball does not fall in and it's such a make or miss game and it's such a fine line. And I've heard Jeff Van Gundy say this before, like good coach, bad coach really determines if the ball go in or not. And I see it all the time. You've sometimes to be successful. Yes, you got to have good players and be a you know good tactician in some areas and all that good. But you've got to be a little lucky along the way. You got to be a little lucky with just your team staying healthy. You got to be lucky that possibly that the guys you recruit are better than maybe that you expected. You've got to be lucky along the way that a couple shots go in a certain game to give you some momentum. I mean, it's really a fine line of the game in coaching. And yeah. It is such a small margin. Doug, you know that. I mean, a free throw here, a free throw there, a turnover there, a whistle. Like, I think college officials, like a call here and a call there can change the outcome of a game. Not intentionally or not, but things can change. And it can change the whole course of someone's career and or season. And it's such a fine line. And so I think there's so much joy out of the game of basketball, and it gives us all so much. But I also do think on those losses, it can wear on. It's not easy when you know when you're invested into it. It wears on you. And then secondly, the game is when you're a coach, it is such a fine line in so many areas. I don't know if you would agree with that or not.
Oh, I agree on every different level there. Every level.
I mean, you know, think about it. When you're a coach, you're constantly thinking, okay. You wake up, you're thinking this, you're thinking that. You're never off.
There's no off switch.
And that's where I tell people, like, yeah, it's not about the money you make or anything. It's not anything to do with that. It's just that you're never off because you're constantly thinking about what do we got to do to run a program, to continue to try to be successful with winning, but then you got to get the guys bet. I mean, there's just so many things moving and there is no off switch. And it doesn't matter if you're off season or not. You're on all the time.
How'd you get the Memphis job?
Oh, I got the Memphis job because I got lucky. Right place, right time. You kidding me? I tell people all the time. Man, I tried to get other jobs. I couldn't even get an interview. The only reason I got the Memphis job, Doug, was because I was John Calipari's assistant. Thank the good Lord he gave me the opportunity to be his assistant. And because he went to Kentucky and in his last 4 years at Memphis, he was the winningest coach in the history of the NCAA in a four-year time period. Nobody wanted to follow him. They tried to hire so many coaches, they couldn't hire anybody. Because nobody wanted the job, because nobody wanted to follow John Calipari. I just happened to be his assistant. I was there. I was excited and ready to go to Kentucky with Coach Calipari. I didn't even think about the Memphis job.
How did it happen? You'd only been there a year. It wasn't like you were there for the whole build. You're only there for a year.
I was only there a year. And
okay, so where were you when you found out first he was going to take the Kentucky job?
Well, if you ever look at his first contract, I'm the signed witness on the contract. So I was at his house like 1 a.m. signing, you know, as his witness to sign the contract. It was incredible because the entire time we were all stuck in his house because there's helicopters in Memphis flying over his house. That's how crazy basketball is in Memphis. There's nothing like it because they were trying to, from the news station, to trying to find, you know, usually in helicopters hovering over someone's house, it's a hostage negotiation, not as a coach.
Or OJ. Yeah.
It's not going, whether you're going to Kentucky or staying at Memphis for a basketball coach, but that's how intense it was. And so we were holed up in his house when he said he was officially going. I stayed there until really late until like I said, 1 a.m. to sign to be the witness of the signing of the contract. But I say all that to say I was excited. It was over like a 7-day. They couldn't hire anyone. I didn't even talk to the administrator. I wasn't. There was no interview. I was gone. I just happened to get a call in the last, like, say, hey, man, the athletic director at the time just said he needed to see me. We had a great recruiting class coming in. John Wall, DeMarcus Cousins, Eric Bledsoe, Xavier Henry. I mean, we had all these guys. And so I thought they hired their head coach and they were going to ask me to stay on as like the associate head coach to try to keep some of the recruits. And I knew I wasn't going to be able to do that because all these guys were coming to play for Calipari. And, you know, that's what the sell was, Coach Cal. And so when I'm going to see the AD was like, you know, he just literally just handed me the job. He just said, take it. Like, cause there was no talk of philosophy. He just, make a long story a short story, he literally just said, do you want the job? Initially, I said no, because I thought he was offering me when he said, do you want the job? I thought he meant to say, do I want to be the associate? That's what I thought. Do I want to be the assistant to stay with the next coach? Then when he told me he was going to be the head coach, you know, that's how I got the job. I've told this to so many people. I could list a million people that were more deserving of me to be the coach at Memphis than I was. I wasn't deserve to be the head coach at Memphis. But Doug, in life, opportunities come at just different times. Doors open when you kind of least expect it. It was just a door open. I'm the first to say I didn't earn that job. Coaches were so much better and more deserving than me to be the head coach at Memphis. I understand I skipped a lot of steps. However, that door opened, and then it's on you to take advantage of that opportunity. And I was there for 7 years, and that 7 years as a head coach allowed me to become the head coach in the ACC at Georgia Tech.
Okay. I have two more for this. This is part one. You're going to do a part two, whether you like it or not. Okay.
Great.
Okay. So here's the first thing. What's the magic to Calipari? I do think he's a much better than perception coach, excellent basketball coach, but there is something to his personality which has allowed him to be a great recruiter. You've lived it, you've felt it. What is it? What's the secret sauce, if you will?
Yeah, no, you're spot on, Doug. Number one is he's a very, very good basketball coach, and people always talk about his recruiting. Obviously, because he's getting great, but he is a very, very good basketball coach. Very, very good. You don't win the amount of wins that he has had and the level that he's won at without being I don't care if you have great players.
It's also challenging because, you know, he and I, and this might have been the last year there, or it might have been a couple years before. He got mad at me because at the start of the season, I said, well, that's how you beat Memphis. You got to slow him. You got to put him in the half court and make him think. So he calls my boss and says, that's a racist comment. I was like, what? So then he calls me. Like, here's what I like about John is he will just call you. Like, he doesn't just go through a bunch of layers. And there's some of these guys, you know, they don't like you and they tell your bosses to not use you, but they'll, to your face, they'll be the greatest. Whereas John was just like, look, you can't say that. And I was like, why? He's like, 'cause you're saying make them think. I have an all black team. You're saying my kids, because they're black, they can't think. It's like, John, that's bullshit. I was like, look, I was like, are they easier or harder to coach because they're younger? He's like, harder. I was like, yeah, because they haven't seen multiple defenses. They haven't seen, you know, all the different ball screen coverages. They haven't seen it. The game hasn't slowed down for them yet. So you put somebody in the half court and you make them have to read the situation instead of just out there hooping. It's like self-scout, John. How would you play? He's like, well, I'd play slow. I was like, well, no shit. That's all I said. So he was like, I understand. He's like, you just got to be very cautious about what you say, because it could be perceived as like, John, we're in a sport where, you know, 75% of the players are black. Like, any comment could be construed as racist if you want to go. He's like, so we had a good back and forth about it. But I actually think that, yes, if you give me Anthony Davis and you give me Eric Bledsoe and you give me, you know, all, but they all come in with agendas, as you know, right? And they all come in thinking they're great players when they're great high school players. They're not great college players. And in a short period of time, you got to make them into a great college player and a better teammate. That's actually harder on some levels than coaches that recruit inferior players, but in the past have had them for 3 or 4 years.
Well, no, Doug, look, I mean, yes, you got to have good talent. He's had great players. And look, part of your job is to get great players. That's part of the There's nothing wrong with that, of getting the best players. I mean, we all want to get the best players, but he is a great coach. There's no denying that. And then secondly, with that, he's a master. If he wasn't a coach, pretend like he wasn't a coach, and he ran a business, he ran a pizza shop, he would be a multi-millionaire being the owner of the pizza shop. His vision in business and marketing is just off the chain. And like, I can't tell you how many times in recruiting we'd be going somewhere and he would say, man, you see that corner spot there, Josh? That place isn't going to make it. But then we take a left. You see that corner spot there? If we start a business in there, or put a restaurant there, a pizza place, it would just go. His vision to see things, I mean, he'd be literally seeing things around the corner before they happen. And he's got an incredible work ethic. Like his energy, and I've told him this before. I'm a high energy guy, Doug. Like I can go, but he is a guy that can be practicing, you know, work the players out, you know, go to a function, go out recruiting, then on the way back, writing his book, you know, writing chapters for, I mean, it's 24/7, 365 with him.
This is what you'll find. They're all like that.
Yeah.
Like if you go and you go backstage with a really successful artist, their ability to dial up the energy when they get on stage is unmatched. You know, like I met like Kenny Chesney and Darius Rucker, like dudes are tired. Like Darius will go play 36 holes of golf. He has to do a meet and greet. He's traveled all over the place, blah, 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 blah. And then all of a sudden, like you got to go on stage and he can just hit the switch and he's got the energy.
Doug,
right.
Doug,
and
no, I was going to say it's anyone in any profession that's at the top of their profession. You're 100% right. It doesn't matter if you're in the music industry, an entertainer, a coach, an athlete, all those people, men or women who are at the high level, there's just something about that of innate ability to, you know, they have a real drive, you know.
It's like an extra gas tank.
Yeah.
That regular people.
And that's not for everybody.
No, it's not. Okay. Last one for part one. You get the Memphis job. You mentioned Xavier Henry. Well, he went to Kansas where his mom went. We know where John Wall and Bledsoe went.
And DeMarcus Cousins.
And DeMarcus Cousins. Right. So he took them all with him. What is that like to, I finally get a job and it's a great job. Now you got to follow a guy who's been incredible. Right. And we know what happened at UMass trying to follow him, and it was hard at Memphis. And I'm sure when he leaves Kentucky, it'll be hard there as well. What is that like to be the head coach at Memphis and you're trying to put together your first roster? And this is before the transfer portal. And you're just kind of patching holes there. What was that like for you?
You know, Doug, one, you're right. Xavier Henry left. I begged his brother. I just needed to fill out a roster. I begged his brother, CJ Henry, a baseball player who was drafted by the Yankees, will you stay on and play? I was begging him. He ended up not staying and playing, but I was begging. I sent out an email to like different, hey, anyone got available players? Like, I got this one guy from Austin, Texas. Thank God he sent me. He told me about this kid who was just, he had some like Division III offers and Division II. I just took the kid sight unseen. They said he was a nice athlete. I took him sight unseen. And he ended up being, his name is DJ Steffens. He ended up being an unbelievable 4-year player for me, you know. And he's gotten some work in the NBA as well too. And so it was. And look, and people,
you never saw him play.
Never saw him play. Just took him on it based on an email. I didn't have any.
Who emailed you?
Coach Max from the D1 Ambassadors AAU team down in Texas. And because I was just looking out, we didn't have enough to play. And so, and let me just say this, most of the guys, the entire recruiting class went to Kentucky.
Kentucky, yeah.
And I wasn't mad about that. Like, people were like, aren't you upset? I says, no. The entire time, like when I was involved recruiting with those guys, All I talked about was playing for John Calipari, and that it was the greatest thing to play for him. Come play for him. I couldn't all of a sudden in the last minute for a whole year recruiting that way, and then in the last minute try and tell Zavi Henry or John Wall, hey, come play for me now. You know what I mean? Everything I said, disregard that. It was not happening. I knew it. So, I wasn't mad, and I just said, hey, if you want to come to Memphis, come, but I get it. Like, man, I get it if you're going to go play with Coach Cal. Like, see ya, you know? And so the reality of it was we had some returning guys that were older, that were seniors. And I always tell people this, when you take over a job, the first year is not the hardest because you usually have some seniors left over from the previous coach. It's the second year when it's the hardest because that's when you're starting kind of from the bottom, starting over. You're young. You have your first recruiting class in. You have a bunch of freshmen. And that's usually the hardest part when you take over a job as a second year. For me, though, Doug, here I am taking over Memphis at 31. Following John Calipari in that environment where in a 50-mile radius, there is nothing bigger than Memphis basketball, you know, and everyone thought I would, you know, most people think you're probably going to last a year or two. It's a monster job. I'm telling you, that thing is a monster job. And following him, I used to tell people, the guy that follows Calipari, you got to be crazy. Like, you got to be crazy to follow this guy. I ended up being the crazy guy because I was just at the right place, right time.
How'd you put together your staff?
You know, I mean, look, I was a first time head coach, and I took my time on hiring, but I hired three assistants at the time that I knew just through the game of basketball, and they all did a good job for me, and they've all, you know, like I hired Jack Murphy, who was with me when I was at Arizona. I hired Glenn Cyprian, who I knew Sip through the business. And then Willis Wilson, who I knew from a long, I used to go to his camps back in the day. So I hired three guys, and then I hired Eric Sebastian, who's now with the Washington Wizards as my ops. And he was with me all 7 years at Memphis. So, you know, and then throughout there, I lost guys to head coaching jobs. Jack Murphy got a head coaching job. Sip ended up getting another great opportunity as an assistant at Texas A&M. Willis Wilson became a head coach again. So I had to keep hiring guys. And that's where I hired Damon Stoudemire, and I hired Jason Gardner, two guys that, you know, from Arizona. They both ended up getting head jobs.
Head coach job, yeah.
Head coaching jobs. I hired a bunch of guys throughout. Luke Walton was worked for me for a short period of time during the lockout. So I had Aki Collins, who's now a top assistant at Penn State, and
you know what's interesting about Damon. Obviously, Jason lost his gig, and Luke and Damon especially, they made a lot of money, right? And the fear with those guys is always like, do you really want to do this, or do you just want to collect a check and have insurance picked up and be a part of a team? How did you know that they really wanted to do it?
Well, you know, for Luke Walton, I think the experience he had with me in college probably showed him saying, I probably don't want to be a college coach. You know, I mean, a lot of things.
It was during a lockout, too.
It was during the lockout, but I had him involved in recruiting, and he was great with the players, but he did not enjoy recruiting. And he was a good recruiter. He was good because he's good with people, but it wasn't being on the phone all the time and going through all that. That wasn't something that was a passion for him, but he's a very good coach. I think from that time here, and I don't want to speak for Luke, but I think he felt, hey, I've been through that experience. I love the NBA. And where Damon, who's done it, and Luke's done it. I thought Luke did a great job with the Lakers. He's done a great job with the Kings. I mean, the Kings are young, and those guys are going to continue to get better. And I know the future's bright with Sacramento. I'm so happy that, because I think Sacramento is going to be a playoff team in the 22 season. And then Damon Stoudemire has done just an incredible job at Pacific. I mean, just awesome job. I mean, taking something over literally at
nothing.
Starting over at zero and how he's built that program and what he's done. He's been coach of the year in the league. And so, yes, both Luke Walton and Damon Stoudemire made a lot of money. They don't need the coaching jobs, but they love coaching. They're great coaches. They're great with people, and they both are very good people. And so to see both their successes and, you know, Damon Stoudemire should get the Trailblazers job. I mean, I don't see why Portland doesn't hire. I think Damon's a really good coach, and he's played in Portland. He knows the NBA. The players love him, you know, and I think he'd be a great, and I'm not speaking for Damon. I just think he'd be a great hire for the Trailblazers.
All right, so here's what I need for part two, okay? We need to discuss your Memphis, Georgia Tech, the best recruiting stories, including your point guard last year, who I love, the hair, and the future, okay? So you got a little time to prep for it, and we'll do it. I really appreciate your time. You've been more than generous, and thanks so much,
Doug,
for joining.
Doug, I really appreciate it. You know, I think about you and your family, and I'm always happy. And I always said this, and you have a great gig at what you do, and you're very good at what you do. I think you'd be a good coach if you ever, I mean, you know basketball, whether you'd ever really wanted to get into coaching. You and I have had some conversations offline about you wanting to be a coach or not. Again, I don't want to speak for you, but I do know your love and passion for the game. And I think you'd be a great coach if you did ever decide to want to go into that avenue.
I appreciate it. You never wanted to hire me, but I do appreciate it.
You have a better gig than you want to be my assistant, I promise you.
All right, Josh, talk to you soon, dude.
Thanks, Doug.
Right, that was pretty fun, wasn't it? Okay, you're going to wait. Part two is amazing, right? We start to get into being a head coach, what it was like at Memphis. We started to talk about putting a team together, what he learned as a head coach, and then you know, moving on and getting the Georgia Tech job, how it all went down and what all of this has been like putting together a team that won the ACC tournament, you know, battling through probation, all the different stuff. We'll get to all that upcoming. Reminder, the Doug Gottlieb Show is daily, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific. By the way, there's an archive of amazing All Balls. Not that this hasn't been good, but just looking through the catalog of them, they're really, really, really good. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. I'm Doug Gottlieb. Download, subscribe, rate, write a review. I think I might actually make a little more money if you write reviews. That's cool. This is All Ball.